following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and New Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine. I have a fantastic program planned because I have an excellent guest, Howard M. Weinberg. Dr. Weinberg is an associate professor of medicine at Rowan School of Osteopathic Medicine. He's a virtual cardiologist. He's a guy who gets to the nitty-gritty, and you're going to be very impressed. I just want to say this program, I am doing this from Dallas, Texas. I'm happy to say that there's some interesting facts about losing weight that have come up in this conference. And just for everybody to realize that it takes about 5% of your body mass to basically get a metabolic benefit, but you don't look better. So remember, if you're going to plan for weight loss and you want to look physically better, you've got to drop over 5%, shoot for at least a 10% loss, and then you'll get a little bit more of the body that you really want. So think about that weight loss. 5% doesn't do it for looks, but it does it for metabolism. Get rid of that diabetes. Get rid of that overweight stuff, but just go to the 10%. So let me introduce Dr. Howard Weinberg. Howard is one of the most academic cardiologists I've ever seen. He's involved both with helping patients get financial help for their medical problems, and more importantly, from my perspective, is to make sure that if I send them a patient, they get better from A to Z, from a guy who reads over and over. So, Howard, welcome to Inside Medicine.
Joe, thank you. I appreciate the time and opportunity to be on the show again.
Fantastic. And I am sure we're going to get you again because you do such a good job. But you're involved with the PAN Foundation, which is a national charitable assistance organization. So can you give a little background of what you're doing to help people pay those bills?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I'm on the board of directors for the PAN Foundation, which is an organization with a mission to help underinsured people with life-threatening, chronic, and rare diseases get the medications and treatment that they need by assisting them with their out-of-pocket costs and advocating for improved access and affordability. The organization was founded in 2004. Since then, PAN has provided more than 1 million underinsured patients across all 50 states with a total of about $4 billion in financial assistance through the nearly 70 disease-specific grants that we have. So we've been on board for a little while now. We've been trying to assist as much as we can to help people.
Well, Howard, that's absolutely phenomenal. And I have to say this, the numbers you gave just go beyond what my mind can really characterize real quick. So who is eligible for financial assistance from PAN? How do they access that network?
Sure. Well, the eligibility requirements, they may vary slightly for each of the disease states that PAN has. But in general, the requirements are they have to be receiving treatment for a given disease, and that's pretty obvious. They need to reside or receive treatment in the United States or the U.S. territories, but they don't have to be United States citizens. They have to have Medicare or private health insurance that covers the qualifying medication. They need to be prescribed a medication or product that's on our PAN list of covered medications, the programs that we currently are supporting now. And they need to have an income that falls at or below a specified percentage of the federal poverty level. And usually that's around 400 to 500% of the poverty level. So that people can understand, to give you a little bit of an example, PAN has an example of fund being the Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Disease Fund. And to be eligible for that fund, they need to fall at or below the 500% of the federal poverty level. Now, this means that a two-person household with an income of $90,000 may be eligible for assistance if they meet some of the other requirements. They're able to find out more about all the available disease funds by going to our website that we have, panfoundation.org, and they can see the particular websites or just particular funds that we're supporting at this time, and we have more funds that are being added all the time. And if you do receive a grant, that grant is for a 12-month period, so people can at least have some financial relief, because we know they're stressed just from having the medical issues that they may have. At least they know for at least 12 months we're going to be able to give them some relief.
So how do the charitable assistance programs like PAN differ from patient assistance programs offered by pharmaceutical companies? Because I think, Howard, you always stress this is not pharmaceutical support.
No, this is not for now. The independent charitable patient assistance programs, like PAN, provide assistance based upon disease conditions rather than particular medications. The charitable organizations also have no influence over prescribing decisions made by the healthcare provider for a given patient, and they're unable to endorse any specific manufacturer. We are specifically held to requirements that are from the U.S. Department of Health and the Office of the Inspector General that we're guided under, so we really can't get involved with any particular physician. But on the other hand, patient access programs that are offered by pharmaceutical companies are medication-specific, meaning that they only provide assistance for a given medication that they themselves manufacture. And in general, manufacturer patient assistance programs support out insurance and those with commercial insurance in need of a specific product. So there's a role for both, but they're more involved in their product and we're more involved in a disease rather than a particular medication.
So I feel the pressure more and more every year, especially in December, when my patients are told that, yes, they can't get a blood pressure pill, or yes, they can't get a lipid profile pill that they've been on for a year or 2 years or many years. And all of a sudden, Big Brother, somewhere along the line, wherever he comes from, comes out and says, this year you can't use this, you can't use that. Last year we saw the biggest hit in my practices from insurer saying they don't want to pay for Synthroid anymore, which has been on the market 40, 50 years and did a great job. So my question to you, Howard, is with the cost of healthcare for our patients being very challenging, are there any bright spots that you see on the horizon? Because I see only no coming up more often.
Yeah, I know. That's been a problem, and the patients keep getting hit more and more with expenses. But there is some at least bright spots out there. With the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed, there are several Medicare Part D reforms that are out there, and this will be enacted starting in 2023. And to kind of let you know a little bit about that, there's going to be an end to vaccine copays for people with Medicare Part D starting January 1st of 2023. Again, for our diabetes patients, there's going to be a limit in the insulin copays to $35 per month, and again, starts in January. And I know there's been some pharmaceutical companies that have been at least out there saying maybe they're going to give insulin for free. Well, I'm not going to hold my breath, but the insulin copays being limited at $35 does supply a lot of hope and support for that for our patients there. But one of the real bright spots that we see is that there's an annual limit that's coming up. The limit starts, or is firm limit, of $2,000 of out-of-pocket costs for people with Part D starting January of 2025. But that limit does come into play, and the limit's about $3,250 or $3,250 starting in 2024. So patients can sit back and they have at least some relief, or at least they know what it's going to be, rather than getting themselves caught in that donut hole, where they have to wait for the catastrophic coverage to come in and they don't really know for sure what they're going to be responsible for. So there's this limit, and I'm happy to see, although $2,000 still for some people, it's a lot of money, and the charitable assistance programs are going to be necessary until we get further reforms. But at this point, we're really...
Howard, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I do want to just point out one thing. This at the end of this year, I had an insurer tell me that I can only give 11 days of insulin to a patient. So what happens, you know, when there's a storm or there's a hurricane or whatever, and all of a sudden I can only give 11 days and the people can't get to the pharmacy to get their insulin. So I just would say this, that to an extent, insurers, at least in the state of New Jersey, have gotten a little bit bold when you limit a patient to 11 days of insulin, which is very scary to me. So I really appreciate, Howard, what you're doing to make sure that PAN thrives and that people who have need get care. Just
John, tremendous. I wanted to mention there is some things that we're trying to do. We recognize there's a lot of issues with social determinants of health. And we've gone even as far as developing new particular support that we can give to our patients. So we know that many patients lack reliable transportation, and that's a major barrier for them getting to healthcare, particularly those patients with chronic conditions. So in 2020, PAN launched its transportation fund to provide financial support to active PAN people that have grants now with PAN, to make sure that they can get access to their healthcare needs and to be able to get to see their physicians. We'll even support them for trying to get themselves to the gym, for social connections and support to be healthy. We'll even support them to try to make sure they have transportation to get to the grocery store so they can get healthy and nutritious foods. So there are other things, there are other avenues we're trying to support so that people are going to be able to maintain a healthy lifestyle. And we're going to get into that a little bit further about the things for cardiovascular health. But we need to make sure that our patients can get there, because if they can't get there, there's nothing that they can do about it. So in addition to the transportation fund, PAN launched what's called the Fund Finder in 2018 that helps track the status of more than 200 funds across the 9 foundations that do similar activity that we're doing, for one convenient area where they can look to see if there's a disease fund available that they can obtain support for. And the Fund Finder is available to patients, to family members, to healthcare providers, or to pharmaceutical professionals to find out the latest information that's out there for disease funds so they can be alerted to what's available. So we're all about trying to help people and make sure that they can get access to the appropriate health care and to access, they can get the appropriate medications that they need and know where they can reach for support. Because these patients are worried and they're stressed, and they have a worry about their diseases that they have and what they're going to do and how it's going to impact their family. We really like to take off the financial burden if we could.
Howard, I salute you. You're a great guy. And now I just want to move Inside Medicine to what you do for a living as Associate Professor of Medicine at Rowan School of Osteopathic Medicine and a practicing virtual cardiologist. Just want to talk about some cardiovascular health in America. Can you give a little update on what is the state of cardiovascular health in America?
Well, cardiovascular health in America, the issues that we're up against still, heart disease and stroke is the leading cause of death. And over one in four deaths in the United States is due to heart disease or stroke. And that totals about almost 2,850,000 patients in 2019. And the reason we kind of stopped at 19 was the 2019-2020 data is really with the COVID data. And that added about another million patients on board for the deaths. It was obviously very tragic. You can look that heart disease is overwhelming. In the world, we had 18.5 million people die from cardiovascular disease. And next beyond that was cancers, and that was 10 million. So, I mean, you're a good 80% over the disease in second place here. But each year we have about 610,000 strokes and about 105,000 heart attacks that are occurring. And the cost to us is about $229 billion, and that was from 2018 data at that point. So We've been doing better over the last couple of decades, but we still have a lot that we can do.
So I just want to comment that, you know, COVID, when it came out that first year, almost beat cardiovascular deaths, to tell you how devastating that was, especially for those in the nursing homes. So I'm happy that COVID is down, and we need to put more emphasis on cardiovascular health. So what are atherosclerotic cardiovascular risk factors that our population should know about so hopefully they can get ahead of the curve and avoid cardiovascular death? What are the factors that a cardiologist looks at and probably even your family doctor, internist, et cetera?
Sure. Well, there's a multitude of risk factors that are out there, but to sort of address them one by one here, hypercholesterolemia, or high cholesterol, affects about 2 in every 5 adults, and that's about 94 million people. And you can see, if we break it down even, 7% of the kids aged 6 to 19 years old, about 7% have high cholesterol that we do need to be worried about and checking on those individuals. But there was an article in JACC, which is a Journal of American College of Cardiology, from August of this year. And what they're doing, they're trying to see where is the risk factor, where are they heading? And the risk factors are heading up, unfortunately. And it's looking like by 2060, which, although that's 38 years away, but the time kind of moves forward, it's 27% increase is projected. And that's going to go to about 124 million people with high cholesterol, which obviously has been a risk factor that we pay close attention to. Other risk factors that we talk about, hypertension. And if you look at the different criteria for hypertension, if we apply the criteria of having systolic pressure less than 140 millimeters of mercury, and it's about 30% of the population have hypertension. But if you pay attention to the newer data, which is from 2017 from the American College of Cardiology, it's about 47% of the population have hypertension. And it looks like that's only going to be increasing. By 2026, we're going to be going up another 25% of the population. And they're projecting that to be about 162 million. We've done better with blood pressure control over the last 50 years. It's improved. But even with our improvements, today's standard from 2020, it's at 25% of the people are controlled. And that's a shame that we're not able to do a whole lot better than that. But there are multiple reasons that we could address. We have multitudes of medications now, and we have done better, but we have a whole lot more to go. If we want to go further into diabetes, which is the realm that you are in every day.
Hold on 1 second. I want to go back to that hypertension, because it's really amazing in my office when someone comes in and is hypertensive. You should see their face when, you know, we'll do a blood pressure, sitting down, feet on the floor, arm resting. And those automatic guys are terrible, but, you know, get a real blood pressure cuff the old-fashioned way. And we see hypertension, and the patient's their face will melt when we tell them you're hypertensive. And there's a high resistance, you know, to take medication. And I try and tell them, listen, we're going to start one medication. But years ago, we used to push the medication, start low and keep going up until we hit the top. But now that most people on hypertension are on like 3 medications, and I'm looking for your input, and that basically that way we don't have to push drugs up. So don't feel that you're failing if you take more than one blood pressure pill, because that way we limit side effects and get significant gains. Your opinion to that?
Yeah, sure. Most people require more than one medication, and we do generally start. I mean, if your pressure when you walk in is greater than 160, you need more than one medication to get you going. And unfortunately, people are definitely resistant, and I struggle with that. Now, initially, I would like to try therapeutic lifestyle modification, and everybody, no matter who they are, whether you're on medication or not, therapeutic lifestyle modification, meaning exercise, they should be getting at least 150 minutes of exercise in a week, and no question. I mean, they need to get that in, because a healthy lifestyle is reduces all these cardiovascular risk factors. So exercise, diet, and medications. And I struggle with patients with their medications. Doc, I don't want to take a medication. But if this medication is going to bring your blood pressure down, reduce the risk of stroke, heart attack, kidney failure, then why would you be resistant to the medication? There are side effects, sure. And most of the side effects, if you have them, those side effects will disappear when you stop the medication. That's in most of the times. But I sit back and I say, listen, I like cheesecake. There is nothing good about cheesecake that I'm going to tell you. I mean, but I do like my cheesecake. But instead, I have to be careful. I have to have a little bit of my cheesecake, sure. But I know that that's not healthy for me, but I enjoy life. All right. Take your medication, reduce your risk factors, bring down the chance. And this is clear. This is a winner for you. And if there is a side effect, we can deal with that. In general, it's reversible. So I want people to be aware that resistance, I understand, but we're trying to protect you and be proactive rather than reactive. And what I mean by that, everyone's really good after they had a heart attack. They're good for at least 6 months, right? And they're good at, take my medications, do everything I do. And then after 6 months, when they realize that they're not going to die, and everything's all good and everything's all right, then they go back. And unfortunately, some of my patients even go back and they start smoking again, which is a challenge. But if they would take the medications, things that we need to do, and we're all here about good lifestyle, therapeutic modification, doing what's right. And I'm even willing to take you off of medications if you get to your goal and we can maintain you there. Now, if a patient can lose 25 pounds and their blood pressure comes down, spectacular. That's great. We'll take you off we'll wean them down and get you off. But in that short time frame, yes, you may need 2, maybe even 3 medications to get your blood pressure controlled.
So Howard, you talked about smoking. I got to tell you the story of how my grandfather got me to stop smoking. I was 5 years old. My grandfather was sitting in his chair. He's got leg edema up the kazoo. At the time, I didn't know that was heart failure. But he hands me an Italian stogie, the worst things in the world, says, take a puff. So I kept coughing, for about 5 minutes. And he said, kid, you got a lesson there. Don't ever smoke. So do you think we could give out Italian stogies to our patients so they would stop smoking?
Yeah, whatever we need to get people to stop smoking. And I guess the best thing is to never start. If you never start, you don't have to stop. But if you look at the data for smoking now, in 1965, there was 42% of the population were smoking. We have done a great job for smoking, although we're stuck right now. But it's about 14% as of 2020. And the population, it's older than 64, it's 9 of 100 people smoke. If you are in the 24 to 44 age group, 14 of 100 smoke. And if you're in the 45 to 64 age group, 15 of 100 smoke. So we do need to get back and get on top of that. But from 65 to where we are, we've made multiple strides. I think we need to continue. There is nothing redeemable about smoking. You can't give me anything good except that it's multiple cardiovascular health issues, multiple cancers, all kinds of issues come into play. It is one of the worst things I've seen out there. And there is no value in smoking.
So as one of the tip-top endocrinologists, do you have any comments about diet? Because I'm actually at an obesity conference right now.
Sure. And to me, and that's something we need to get into more, obesity. From 1950 to the year 2000, our obesity epidemic has gone up 214%. And I mean, it's just dramatic where we've gone. And currently at this time, approximately 31% of U.S. citizens are overweight and 42% are obese. Right, that's just crazy statistics, and that's our driving force. We are in the obesity epidemic at this point now, and if we can get people to diet and I don't even say diet. Diet's the wrong word to use. It's really a lifestyle change and modification, not a diet, because diets end. So I want the people to have healthy choices. Our issues that we have in this country, though, are magnified because there are populations that are at risk, and they're at risk because they don't have access to healthy food. They don't have the affordability to getting healthy food. We talked about medications, but they don't have the affordability for medication. They don't have affordability for food, and they don't have the education to know that they need to get these medications, to get these foods, to get to exercise. I mean, there's an awful lot out there, and it all deals with social determinants of health. You need access, you need education. And without that, we struggle with all these risk factors to get people on board. We went through physical inactivity. I mean, I don't know about you, when I was growing up, we used to come home and we'd go outside and we'd play street hockey outside. And we were always out there playing until mom called and said, it's time for dinner. Now, you don't see that anymore. The population, they have a specific routine, and there's an awful lot of people that are playing video games or they're just not exercising. It's just, that's my commentary, but I think you need people to be more active, particularly as they're moving along in life.
So what I just want to give a final comment about diet from my perspective is what happens is when people lose weight, they want to look better, and I think that's a great motivation. But the problem is that when you lose 5% of your body mass, you don't look better because all you're doing is getting rid of visceral fat. There's two types of fat. Subcutaneous, the stuff under your skin, and the deep stuff around your organs, inside your gut, et cetera. So the first 5% that you lose of your weight, you're basically making yourself live longer because you're getting rid of the fat that's around your organs in your belly that make you diabetic, et cetera, et cetera. And to really want to look good, if your goal is to look good for the wedding coming up, you got to go for 10%. So I just hope people, when they go to a plan, weight loss drugs, which are phenomenal now, and just have great, you know, great future for people to lose weight. You can't lose 5% if you want to lose look good. You got to lose 10%. So please go for the 10%.
We're seeing some dramatic improvements now because the weight loss drugs are also cardiovascular drugs. So we see these benefits with the GLP-1 agonists and the SGLT2 inhibitors for patients. Now, we may not use them at the same dosage for some of the weight loss drugs, but we see our patients come in now with, you know, 5 to 10% weight loss over several months now. So we've had a dramatic benefit, and that's a secondary effect for us because we're using them for their cardiovascular benefits.
That's a two-for-oneer that I love to hear. So now going to diabetes, you know, which actually I live in, but the answer is that there's so many medications today that are brand new that give you what Howard's just talking about. You get less heart attacks, you get less diabetes, you get less of this, less of that. So the weight loss drugs can make a significant impact. But if you're somebody who's lost a lot of weight and keep going back, don't forget to think about bariatric surgery. Coming up soon, we're going to have a specialist who wrote a book on bariatric surgery. She's fantastic. She's going to be with us, I think, in next week or the week after. So again, you got to get at least 10%, but if you don't get where you want, you got to think about going to the next step. So Howard, let me ask you about physical inactivity, because I'm sure you guys push people to take that walk.
We are pushing them. I want my patients out there exercising. And in fact, the concept I give them is I'd rather them do something that they enjoy to do. And I mean, I'm actually a pickleball enthusiast. I love going out there and playing pickleball. And you get out there, it's a social sport, but you enjoy what you're doing and you're out there running around. You're getting your 10,000 steps a day as a side effect. So if my patients can find something that they like to do and the side effect is they get exercise, then that's a win-win all around. Because, yeah, I can convince them, you know, they go to the gym, they walk, and it's all good, and I want them to do that. But I want them to enjoy what they're doing, enjoy their life, and I can find something where they enjoy what they do and the side effect is exercise. Wow, that's a win-win all around. So some of my patients have actually gone and actually played pickleball with some of my patients, which is just a ton of fun. So they're enjoying themselves. They're getting their exercise. They go home. And, you know, when you exercise and you enjoy what you're doing, you go home at the end of the day, I find that I eat better, that I'm not sitting there eating the carbs all day long. I'm eating more healthy foods. So that's the project that I think that everyone should try to address. Do something you like to do with the side effect being you get exercise.
So, Howard, I just want to move on. You gave me a call after one of the programs that I did, and I was talking about aspirin. And you certainly know more about aspirin than me. And you that's one of the reasons I wanted to make sure you got on this show. So can you just give me where aspirin is for primary prevention in heart disease, and how about secondary? And feel free to beat me up.
There you go. No, well, I'm not going to beat you up because you are doing a spectacular job. There's never a reason to beat you up. First, if you want to talk about what is secondary prevention and what's primary prevention? Well, secondary prevention really deals with someone who has had a vascular event. So that patient who has had a heart attack, the patient who's had a stroke, the patient who has vascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, where you know, they have pain when they walk and they needed some type of procedure to be done, or they don't even need the procedure, but the point being they have known clear-cut vascular disease. That's secondary prevention, so they've had an event. So they went back and they looked at some of the data, and this was published in the British Medical Journal in 2002. This was the Anti-Thrombotic Trialist Collaboration, which was a meta-analysis, and basically they showed with the use of aspirin, you had a 22% reduction in non-fatal heart attacks, non-fatal strokes, and an overall cardiovascular death. So that was a clear winner that aspirin is indicated for secondary prevention. And to just give you a number, I would like to talk a little bit about number needed to treat. So to prevent one cardiovascular event, it was 1 in 50 that needed to be treated. And for the side effect of bleeding, it was 1 in 400. So it was a clear winner. And then they looked back and they also tried to look at what's the dose aspirin. So there was a trial looking at the doses of aspirin to use, and that was called the adaptable trial. And they looked at 81 milligrams of aspirin, 325 milligrams of aspirin, and they kind of moved forward looking at some other studies to postulate what's the best dose to use. And they came up again and again, 81 milligrams in the United States is what's offered. In other countries, it may be 75 milligrams or 80 milligrams. But you get the cardiovascular benefit with the baby aspirin, and you don't have as much of the bleeding as you do have with the higher doses of aspirin. So that's one point to bring out. One of the other things I did want to mention, just doing it, that with aspirin, out in the general population, it's felt a lot of people take aspirin. So 1 in 4 patients that are greater than 40 take aspirin, but unfortunately 23% are self-prescribed. So there's issues with that, and I think we do need to get into that because people need to be aware of what they're doing, right? So the difference between that and primary, and that's where we head to next. Primary is people who don't have any vascular disease or who haven't had a heart attack or haven't had a cardiovascular event, should they be taking aspirin or not? And that's the difference between the primary and the secondary stuff.
So give us the scoop on the primary.
All right. Well, if we look at primary, right, there were, if you look, United States Preventive Task Force recommendations, well, they've changed. And why did they change? But in 1988, right, there was a study called the Physicians Health Study. Big study, a lot of patients. And that was published, again, in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it showed a 45% reduction in heart attack, stroke, or dying from a heart attack or a stroke. So aspirin was recommended. Big deal, big study, had a major effects. Okay, so we moved forward that people were taking aspirin. So what changed? All right, in 2018, there were 3 landmark trials that were done. And those 3 landmark trials, I think we talked about that in the past, but those landmark trials included the first one being the ASCEND trial. And the ASCEND trial was, again, published in the New England Journal. It had about 15,000 patients. The average age of the patients was 63, and these were diabetic patients. And they were on statins, they were on blood pressure medications. And at the end of the day, they showed that there was a 12% reduction in the risk of a major cardiovascular event and a 30% increase in the risk of major bleeding. The absolute reduction was 1.1% for a cardiovascular event. So the number needed to treat in that case was 91 to get one benefit. There was an absolute increase of 0.9% for major bleeding. So the number needed to harm was 1 in 112. So they were fairly close to each other. And the overall conclusion from that study was that the bleeding risk, which was a substantial bleeding risk, what counterbalanced the small benefit that you had from to having a cardiovascular event. So you had to really address which patient you should or shouldn't use. And that's, we kind of get to that a little bit more, but that was the one study that showed maybe there's a benefit, but you need to be careful in what you're doing. The other two trials were the ARRIVE trial, and that was in patients with moderate risk of cardiovascular disease, and moderate risk was considered, in this case, between 5 and 20%, and their average risk for this patient population was 17%. And basically, this showed no significant cardiovascular benefit with the use of aspirin, which was a baby aspirin, but there was an increase in gastrointestinal bleeding, all right, major bleeds that occurred. And the other trial was called the ESPRIT trial, which was in a healthy elderly population. Patients were 65 to 70 years old, and there was no significant cardiovascular benefit, but there was a 30% increase in the risk of major bleeding. So those were the three landmark trials that were looked at back then, saying, hey, aspirin at this point, maybe we shouldn't be using this in most of our patients. So the United States Preventive Task Force looked at this, and they looked at a pooled about 11 trials, 30,000 patients, and basically they looked at the totality of the evidence, and that showed that there may be a bit of a reduction in non-fatal heart attack and stroke, but there was no change in mortality for heart attack or stroke. So they moved fast forward and they said, okay, let's take a look at our patients and let's have a discussion with each of our patients, and we can decide based upon the patient's risk level, their bleeding level, who or who should not be getting an aspirin prophylactically or for primary prevention. And that's sort of the history we're at. But I guess, Joe, the question that people ask is, what's changed? What would have changed in that time frame between 1998 and between 2018? And a lot of what's changed, because we had multiple studies in the past that showed benefit, and we showed benefit utilizing aspirin, which was that one major study, but we had multiple showing benefit from changes in blood pressure, cholesterol, cigarette smoking, and all that improved, and a number of medications came out that we could use for hypertension. The statins took off, the Medicaid reducing people's cholesterol, people stopped smoking. All that changed from 1998 to fast forward to 2018. So I think that's the reason why we see the change that's occurred in medicine. It's not just a random process. There's reasons for our changes, and then when those changes happen, we have to change our therapeutic modification for people. So yeah, I don't want people just to think, well, 1998, it was one way, now it's another way. There are reasons why these things change, and we have to accommodate them.
Wow, so that was an excellent explanation, and that's just eye-opening. So let me just ask you this, does enteric aspirin change the flavor? But I think you found out the answer is no.
Okay. No, well, for looking, there's never been, what I can tell you, head-to-head study. So some of this, you know, you can have a discussion with your doctor, particularly what you want to do. But if you're looking at enteric-coated aspirin versus non-enteric-coated aspirin, all right, there's a study in 2017, and if you look at aspirin, I want people to be able to think, why do we use aspirin? What's the overall theme to it? And obviously, you're trying to block that sticky platelet from clotting. So if the people can have an idea, I mean, over you block up your artery by having that platelet come in and they all aggregate together. So the aspirin is supposed to block or make that platelet less sticky so it doesn't bind onto what we call fibrin, which is sort of like a matrix out there when people need to clot. So we block that, and the issue for aspirin is, all right, is it going to cause us to bleed, and is it going to have your beneficial effect? So if you use an uncoated aspirin in someone who's having a heart attack, and we say, okay, person's having an acute event right now, they're having a heart attack, and we want to get aspirin in immediately. We know that they chew their aspirin. They're chewing usually 4 baby aspirin, and they're chewing them up, and it gets absorbed through the mucosa really quick, right? And it has that effect. Well, there was the concept that, okay, is the bleeding effect occurring because we're having a direct erosion occur in the stomach, and that aspirin sitting in the stomach, it doesn't make you feel good, and you're sitting there and it's eroding through your gastrum, or it causing a hole in the stomach. Well, the reason that occurred is really not because it's sitting in the stomach. It's the effect that it actually has in its metabolism when it's in the system. And in the system, aspirin in there, it comes in there and blocks what we call the COX-1 inhibitor, which deals with stimulating or blocking the effect of thromboxane A2 or blocking the effect of our prostaglandins. And when you block the effect of the thromboxane A2, you're blocking the ability for the platelet to be sticky. And that's what you want. But when you block the effect of some of the prostaglandins, then you block the ability for the mucosa in the stomach to build up. And the reason that you have the bleeding occurs because you have loss of that protection that's there, and you allow that you have more, the acid pH is there, and it will allow the stomach to be more susceptible to gastric erosions and to bleeding. So if you want a reliable absorption of your aspirin through your system, the reliable absorption comes when it's a non-coated aspirin, so you get your reliable effect, and you get the platelets that are not so sticky, all right? And we know for sure, they did a bleeding time, which is a measure of how the platelets functioning, and the bleeding time was more reliable when they had it a non-coated aspirin, whereas the enteric-coated or the protected aspirin, which dissolved in below the stomach in the intestines, that had less reliable absorption. And with less reliable absorption, they determined, they called this aspirin pseudo-resistance. Where they're not resistant to the aspirin, they just don't get the absorption of the aspirin. So for my patients, if I want to have that platelet sticky effect to go, I want to get that to go away, I make sure that they get a non-coated aspirin. And the enteric-coated aspirin, you know, there may be a benefit, or I shouldn't say there may be a benefit. It may be just as good in some patients because you're looking for that long-term effect over months or years. But at this point, it's a little bit uncertain to me. So since there's an uncertainty out there, and I don't see a benefit from GI bleeding with respect to either one of the aspirins, but I see a benefit in knowing that I'm going to have my platelet less sticky, I'm going to have my patient take a non-coated aspirin.
Howard, I like you did a beautiful job explaining that, and I appreciate it. And your research is just like Howard Weinberg always is, thorough and to the point. So let me just move on, but I definitely would recommend that everybody follow Dr. Weinberg's suggestion because he's nailed it down. Let's talk about a case study. Say you're a 61-year-old male and you have a family history of coronary artery disease. Say your dad had a MI at 51, but he was a smoker.
So how old is this patient? 61?
51. 61-year-old male, 61.
Okay.
And he works as a carpenter, and you do a calculation, as you always do. His 10-year risk of atherosclerotic coronary vascular disease event is about 20%. His labs are normal, and his blood pressure is 128 over 74. What does a cardiologist like yourself go through to try and figure out how to maximize this guy's long-term cardiovascular health?
Okay. So I have a 51-year-old patient, and he has hypertension, you said?
No history of MI or vascular disease, so I would say
no vascular.
No.
So no vascular disease at all. Okay.
Right.
So what if we sit back and, you know, I think you, if you gave me about, I would plug his data into what's called the atherosclerotic cardiovascular risk factor estimator. So it's sort of what it's referred to as the pool cohort equation, or part of that. And it's the only validated one in the United States. Now, there are other risk factor calculators that you can use that are used in other countries that are specific for their population. But this is the one estimator that we have. And there are pluses and minuses. There are some patients that are overestimated, some patients that may be a little underestimated. But we come up with what is your 10-year risk. We can even come up with what is your lifetime risk for someone who is less than 59. And then we come up with what is the optimal risk if we do that based upon your risk factors. So, you know, you'd want to take a look. And in your patient here, if it came up to be that he was 20% or higher, then that patient straight away, I mean, he would go on a cholesterol lowering medication for certain, right? But that patient is at high risk for developing cardiovascular disease in the next 10 years. So that patient's cholesterol would need to come down. Now, did this patient have diabetes or no?
No.
Okay. So at this point, I'm looking to get somewhere between a 30 to 50% risk reduction, and I probably would be starting with a moderate dose statin in this patient population to begin. And then we would see where we would go, but I would also be talking about therapeutic lifestyle modification, making sure that we're getting our exercise there. How much did this patient weigh? What was his body mass index, or what was his weight?
I didn't make that up. I'm sorry.
Okay.
You have to plug that in.
You would be addressing. You're addressing all these risk factors here. So you're talking initially about therapeutic lifestyle modification. So I'm getting make sure I get my exercise in place and trying to get to my appropriate body weight for him, and then we get to, is this a patient that should or should not be on aspirin? So when I take a look at this particular patient, I'm going to go back to what the United States Preventive Task Force looked at. And they went through and they were trying to focus on patients between the ages of 40 and 59, secondary to the increasing prevalence of the disease. Now, remember, prevalence deals with the number of people in a population with disease, versus incidence, which is the number of people in a population who already have the disease. And the prevalence in someone who's 40 to 49 was about 2 to 5%, but it goes up to 7 to 30% from 50 to 59, and our patient was in that category here. So I'd be sitting back saying, okay, he's got a 20% risk. Where does he stand now with regards to his risk enhancing factors? So, I mean, when I look at risk-enhancing factors, I want to sit back and say, okay, again, what is my totality of evidence looking at this and trying to put him in all together and say, okay, family history. I think you gave me that his family history is positive. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So he has a positive family history. And then I would take a look, is this gentleman smoking now? Are we controlling his blood pressure? Are his lipids at the baseline we need to get him at? And additionally, if those are or not under control, it would give me one angle to look at. But I could also look at what's called a coronary artery calcium score. And what that is we take a patient and we utilize the CAT scan technology. Generally takes about 30 to 45 seconds to do. And we take a look at the arteries and see if they have deposition of calcium within the arteries. And if they have any deposition that's there, that is indicative of an atherosclerotic process that is developing. Now, based upon the number that they have, and that number initially, this is the one study you really want to be a zero. But if that number is greater than zero, then you have some disease developing. Based upon what that number is, can tell you the potential for that to be a critical disease or whether that's a progressive disease. But regardless of what it is, if you have a positive number, those people need to be treated. And that sometimes helps with some of those patients that are a little resistant to treatment. You know, I can do it myself. I don't have to worry. I don't need medication. I don't believe in medication. Well, when they start seeing that they actually have a disease process going on, then those patients are much more likely to say, hey, you know, let's at least give it a chance and try to take some of the medication to help prevent my disease from developing. But not only do I look at their risk-enhancing factors, I have to look at their bleeding risk, because we already have defined that there's a small benefit for patients to be placed on aspirin. So I don't want to potentiate the risk of bleeding. So when I take a look at some of the patients, I may say, okay, what is the risk of bleeding in this patient? Has he had a prior GI bleed? Does he have peptic ulcer disease? Is he greater than 70 years old? It's obvious that he is not. Does he have problems with low platelet count? Does he have liver disease? Does he have chronic kidney disease? Or is he taking chronic steroids for some reason? Is he taking some non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for his arthritis every day? So that may be people taking Motrin or Advil or something in that category. So you weigh your bleeding risk versus your risk of having further progression of vascular disease. And in this gentleman, you know, I'm not so sure. The only thing I see here, I see a family history, but I don't know about the control of his risk factor. So far, I'm at this point leaning against putting on aspirin right now.
Okay. And do you want to go for the audience? How do you decide on the cholesterol? Is there an LDL, bad cholesterol number, that would make you move forward?
Okay. Well, again, when we went through here, we take a look. When I calculate up his the atherosclerotic cardiovascular risk of his disease, I take a look at his total cholesterol, his LDL cholesterol, his HDL cholesterol. I take a look at all those numbers, and I come up with his potential for his disease to progress. If his number is less than 7.5, then he is really considered more of a lower risk patient. If he's between 7.5 to 20, intermediate risk, and if he's at greater than 20%, then he's a high risk patient. Now, I may take a look at patients and I'd say, okay, if I start off with an LDL that is greater than 190, automatically, those patients will go on cholesterol medications. That's straight away. Those patients may frequently have familial hypercholesterolemia and probably heterozygous, because homozygous is a very rare form that we see in this country. So we would take that; those people automatically go on. In the patient, in his patient population, if he's greater than 20%, his LDL is way too high for him. I don't know if you had particular numbers for this particular patient, but if you're greater than 20% of a risk to developing disease, you go on a statin. And then you take a look, if you're a diabetic patient between 70 and 189, those people are automatically going on statins. So in this particular patient, I'm taking a look and saying, hey, okay, he's 20%, and no question, his LDL is going to be greater than 70 if he's at 20% risk level. So I would be putting him on a statin and probably, again, starting at least at a moderate dose statin, looking for a 30 to 50% reduction, and then going from there in order to achieve that. Now, there's some data that we could talk about later, but there's a new marker. Now, I shouldn't say new marker. It's a marker that's out there called LP little a, and that is a low-density lipoprotein with an apoprotein A moiety to it, and that is a very atherogenic particle. It's prothrombotic, it's inflammatory, it's atherogenic, and those markers, the current recommendations, at least the European guidelines, is at least measure it once in a lifetime, because those patients, usually this is one that stays there, it's either high or not high. And then we didn't have therapeutic medications for them. Although there are some that do have some effect, there are some that we can talk about later on down the road that are in studies now and probably will be coming out 2024 is what I think they're projecting, that they may be released if the data is good. And preliminary data would support that it may be good. So that's a marker that you can look for, particularly people that get their LDL cholesterol down, but still have an alpha protein A level that's high, or have a recurrent cardiovascular event, even despite having a lower LDL. So There's an awful lot.
Let me hop in 1 second. So what happens is most people didn't worry about LPA because we didn't have medication that can treat it. But you're intimating that there's one on the market that now is, but it's you have to go to the doctor's office and
I don't want to say that there is nothing on the market right now that is released for Lp(a). There are the PCSK9 inhibitors, which are injectable medications that we're giving that do have an effect in Lp(a), but it's not indicated for their treatment of Lp(a). The ones that are potentially coming out, they have a dramatic increase, a dramatic decrease in Lp(a) of about 75% to 80%. So you're seeing some substantial, but those medications are not released yet. But if you do have an Lp(a) that's up and your cardiologist is looking to treat you, there are some medications that, as a side effect, will reduce your Lp(a).
So what you're saying is that if you have a family history of early heart disease, that you should get an LPA study, which would also enhance, the cardiologist would think about enhancing how aggressive he would treat you if your LPA is up, and help is coming, but not here yet.
Help is coming, not here yet, but your cardiologist is going to be aware because, cardiologists know. They're all on board. They're out of study. They all research. They all read all the time. And they're going to be aware that the PCSK9 inhibitors do have about a 20% reduction in your Lp(a) right now. And there's that one that's on board. There's also a medication called inclisiran, which is also does have an effect on your Lp(a) too. They're out there, but the newer ones are coming, and there's a wealth of good stuff that's coming. And that's what they're saying. That's what we're talking about. Over the last 50 years, we've had lots of medicines come out, and that's why the health has gotten better. I mean, my take-home message in some respects is Lp(a) is a problem, or obesity is a problem.
So, Howard, we're coming to the end of the show. Can you give people how they can get in touch with you? You're a fantastic cardiologist, and you do your work, you study. So tell people how they can get in touch with you if they're interested.
Sure. I'd be more than happy. People like to get in touch with me. The office phone number is 856-589-0300. I have an office in Berlin. I have an office in Washington Township, and I have a new office in Mullica Hill. And I'm with Virtual Cardiology, which has 80 to 100 cardiologists. So we can service patients all over South Jersey.
Howard Weinberg, thank you for hopping on. Get that calcium score. Inside Medicine, over and out. Joe Fallon, we'll see you next week. We're going to get Howard back. Thank you.